Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Campbell McGrath, whose new book, Pax Atomica, has recently been published by Echo. We're here at the library of the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe, New Mexico, one of my favorite places to tape, and there is a small audience of admirers with us. Now, it's funny, Campbell. This new book excites from its flap blurb the announcement that it's both a continuation and a new direction from the previous books, which include the first one, Capitalism, American Noise, Road Atlas, Spring Comes to Chicago, the Florida Poems. In what way do you take it to be a new direction?
Well, I think it's more of a continuation than a new direction, first of all. You know, so there's a certain amount of false promise in that flap copy there. But, I mean, I actually most significantly view this book as the kind of closing of a cycle in my work, in that I kind of see a real linkage amongst these six books. I mean, I really feel that Pax Atomica goes back and talks very much to American Noise in the kinds of poems they are, the more kind of traditional lyric poems and the way form is used in the book. If it's forward-looking, it's in poems like The Human Heart that are kind of opening up to a not narrowly American topic or subject area, which is something we spoke about earlier. And so it's more of a continuation. It's more of a kind of, I think, completing of a cycle, of a circle, than it is looking forward. But I hope that it still continues to advance the project.
Now, Campbell McGrath has, in a sense, resurrected in our time a certain kind of American poem, which, in a sense, begins with Whitman. Carl Sandburg wrote it. Allen Ginsberg wrote it sometimes. It's a kind of epic poem of the American continent, and its style is collage in a certain sense, in that laid state next to state, we live in a country of geographical, emotional, political contradictoriness, and therefore oxymoron has been the way in which people have described this work. Joyful rage tends to be one of the terms used. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought about was the epigraph to Bob Haas's book, Praise. A sea captain facing a monster of the deep is asked what he'll do in the face of such a behemoth, and he says, I think I'll praise it. And praise seems to be the dominant tone in these books, even praise of the horrific. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I can. I think that's fair to say, and I think that, you know, joy is the dominant emotion, if praise is also the dominant, you know, voice. It was important to me. Robert Haas was a real significant figure in my thinking about poetry, and his ability to praise the world and to speak with joy mixed with sorrow always seemed like a great model. It seemed that so many poetry is dominated by despair in our time, or by a retreat into abstraction, that I was really seeking to be joyful and to be celebratory, even in a world that we all live in, which we all know to be so far less than perfect as to be, you know, indescribably so. But nonetheless, you know, we go on, and you know, we can, then it becomes a kind of Beckettian issue. You know, I can't go on, I'll go on. The very horror of the situation necessitates, I think, you know, praise and joy, just as along with the despair, the outrage, all of the above.
Now, there's an epic that begins and stops before it starts in this book. It's almost as if it wants to be the beginning of a very long poem, but it knows better. That poem is Woe, and I thought I'd ask you to read it now. This is Campbell McGrath reading the poem Woe from the new book's Pax Atomica.
Woe. That's W-O-E, woe, too, by the way, as opposed to the woa that of reining in the horses. It might be more apropos in Santa Fe in some regards. Woe. Consider the human capacity for suffering, our insatiable appetite for woe. I do not say this lightly, but the sandwiches at Subway suck. Foaming lettuce, mayo like rancid bear grease, meat the color of a dead dog's tongue. Yet they are consumed by the millions and by the tens of millions. So much for the food. The rest I must pass over in silence.
A poem that announces insatiability and millions upon millions. In other words, it seems to be making a great joke of the kind of poem you'd written before, in which this would be the first stanza leading to some 15 pages, and it's almost as if it's a present because our appetite for woe and the occasions for woe seem so vast and manifold. It's like this book is going to click off and say, you know, we share this woe.
That's interesting, Michael. I think that's maybe part of the forward-looking aspect of the book, too, is learning to bite my tongue. You know, learning to, I mean, because I do readily fall into a kind of cataloging Whitmaniacal frenzy, that what I really like about the poem is its brevity, its willingness to pass over in silence. So learning the power of silence and the unsaid is kind of where what I've been working at. You know, if you're naturally glib and prolix, then to learn the value of silence has been important.
Now, one of the things I noticed, as you go from book to book, the books take on popular culture of previous decades and eras. This book is the pop culture of your own era. It's the Subway store. It's Xena the Warrior Princess. It's rock and roll, whereas previous books were Bob Hope, 7-Eleven, Chuck E. Cheese. In other words, you've come up to your own time, and that these are poems in which the affection and the despair about what the culture has thrown up around us is very, very evident, and the ambivalence soars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the area in which, you know, I feel like my work is still, you know, mining the same vein, in that I agree that it moves on. But, you know, that poem, Woe, my first book, Capitalism, started with, you know, grew out of some early poems that were called the Capitalist Poems, Capitalist Poem number 5, number 7, number 22, etc. And then for a long time, I didn't write that kind of poem because the Bob Hope, the epic kind of mode took over. But then I remember people asked me, oh, are you ever going to write any more capitalist poems? And I said, no, I don't think so. And then I wrote that poem, Woe, whose original title was Capitalist Poem number 46. And I said, gosh, I am writing more capitalist poems, like against my better judgment, in essence. But they just kind of sprung out of that, and there are 5 or 6 or 8 more. So in a way, for me, that's both, you know, the Subway is both, you know, a contemporary manifestation, but it's the same thing as a 7-Eleven, you know, for all its differences. And, you know, I fell back into that kind of more minimalistic voice. The 7-Eleven poems were more kind of William Carlos Williams-y, and that's a little more mini mock epic, as you said. But it's that same notion of both of attempting to express one's ambivalence, the depths of one's ambivalence, meaning not that one doesn't feel, but that one feels passionately on both sides of the issue, and that, you know, to give both voice to both is the only way of finding some way to talk about it at all.
Now, it interests me that whereas once upon a time we talked about poets being poets of place, and by place that meant geography. In your case, that place, to some extent, is Chicago, and it doesn't just mean the city of Chicago, which is deeply celebrated in the course of the poems. It's the intellectual environment, especially that area of anthropological and sociological and architectural study that grew up around the University of Chicago. So it's almost as if in the DNA of these poems is a kind of thinking about America that had its birth there in the Heartlands Universities, where so many of the great thinkers were teaching. How did you come on these examinations of capitalism, of cargo cults, of Louis Sullivan's architecture and the way architecture reflects us?
Well, you're absolutely right that it is just Chicago-derived. I mean, it's University of Chicago-derived, as well as the city and everything else. And I just, you know, ended up – I mean, I ended up going to college at the University of Chicago, and suddenly the kind of native, you know, kind of smirking intelligence I had found this vehicle to make sense of the world, you know, in the kind of vision – of, you know, of deep historical intelligence that they value so much at Chicago, that says, you know, to understand anything, we need to understand broadly. We need to understand architecture, social systems, economic systems. We can't just pick an aspect out. And that perfectly meshed with my, it turned out that made, that helped me make sense of the world. And I've been writing out of that sense of what I do understand or how I might go about understanding that they really gave me there.
Well, the miracle of these poems is not just their accessibility, but their enormous comical parade of accessibilities. It seems as if poems that have grown out of so much complex and sophisticated thought should be difficult, but you have the voice, the great American voice of the snake oil salesman selling nostrum, selling solutions or ideas to explain it all. Was accessibility a part of the project?
Absolutely, a big part of the project. Writing, you know, I think at its, you know, the apogee of this is in the Bob Hope poem, the long poem, which is a celebration of Chicago as well of exploration of capitalism, many things, but is my most the Chicago moment. And really, it was a desire to speak both to those, you know, professors who trained me at Chicago at the most kind of erudite levels of analysis and to, like, you know, the guy next to me, the 7-Eleven microwaving a burrito, and say, I want both of those members of the audience to equally be able to appreciate or access what I'm talking about. I don't want to have to pick one or the other. And that's remained hugely important to me in my writing.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Campbell McGrath, author most recently of Pax Atomica, published by Echo. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Campbell McGrath about his new book of poems, Pax Atomica. I'm going to ask you to read a short poem which seems to me to be at a meeting point of the lyric and the ironic, called The Human Heart.
Thanks, Michael. I will read that poem. The Human Heart. We construct it from tin and ambergris and clay, ochre, graph paper, a funnel of ghosts, whirlpool in a downspout full of midsummer rain. It is, for all its freedom and obstinance, an artifact of human agency in its maverick intricacy, its chaos reflected in earthly circumstance, its appetites mirrored by a hungry world like the lights of the casino in the coyote's eye. Old as the odor of almonds in the hills around Solano, filigreed and chancelled with flavor of blood oranges, fashioned from moonlight, yarn, nacre, cordite, shaped and assembled valve by valve, flange by flange, and finished with the carnal fire of interstellar dust. We build the human heart and lock it in its chest and hope that what we have made can save us.
Campbell McGrath reading The Human Heart from his new book, Pax Atomica. Now, first of all, it seems to me that this poem has a tradition, that the language of destruction in Philip Levine's They Feed They Lion, which mentions cordite and iron ore and the heap of junked earth, which is going to be set on fire and be something new, the permanence of destruction. And he said that when he was driving through the Detroit of the riots, that he saw this fire and realized that it was testament to something else permanent, the permanence of rage. This is an attempt, it seems to me, in your poem, to take that thing of rage about how the human heart has been made more and more from inanimate objects and turn it back into love.
Yeah, it really is. That's a love poem not the explicit kind of love poems I enjoy writing to my wife Elizabeth, but a kind of love poem to the human capacity for love. And a kind of willingness to risk, baldly asserting that, that's our only chance for salvation. It's kind of falling into sounding like John Lennon, unfortunately, at his loopiest, but. It was a poem that was risking sincerity and authenticity of a certain kind, which for a deep-dyed ironist is a complicated thing to do indeed. I just the poem came out of a kind of emotional extremity and just suddenly feeling like I don't know what else there is to say. You can write about 7-Elevens and subways and freeways and America, but somewhere else lies this other truth that is, transcendent and kind of universal and just came out of me.
One of the things that moves me and I think enters is incorporated in these new poems most deeply. In Spring Comes to Chicago, juxtaposed with the Bob Hope poem, are poems about becoming a parent, about your wife's pregnancy. But here, there's that sense of no more 4 a.m.s, no more drunk in the early dawn, no more heavy metal, no more rock and roll. There are children here, and they have a whole legacy. You announce in one of the travel poems that it's time to move on and give way to them. And the travel takes you into the lobby of the hospital where you're waiting for the first one's birth, aware that you've come to a new stage. Can you speak about that sense of tender obligation that having children has brought to your poems?
It's been a complete transformation. That's which started in Spring Comes to Chicago, which, as you say, is a book about the kind of imminent arrival of the first of those kids, which is now just about 13 years ago. And then the next couple books, the children are kind of there one way or another and, creeping around in some of the poems as infants and now as, preteens. It's just transformed me as a person. And so, therefore, the degree to which I'm reflected in the work just bears that out. I actually think that at this point, the book Pax Atomica ends with my sons Sam and Jackson talking a little bit and bringing me back to my own childhood and then making a kind of loop of father to son to father to son. But I think that I feel now that they've outgrown my work and that I kind of need to leave them hands off. When your kids are infants, you have this proprietary sense that, you own them and they're yours and you can put them in your poem if you want to. And now that they're so entirely their own human beings, I feel like I need to maybe step back. And if I'm going to address them, I need to do so more on my own turf. I think I better – they're very much their own. They don't like that idea. They say, but no, put us in the poems, Dad. But I say, I don't know. I think maybe it's inappropriate.
Well, it seemed to me that although you'd written alphabet poems before, that their presence here steadily has something to do with reading children's books, because, you know, A is for Amy who fell down the stairs. Yeah. B is for Basil assaulted by bears. And so I wanted to ask you to read one of them, because, you know, when I came to the end of Xena Warrior Princess, it was only as we got to XYZ that I realized it was an alphabet poem. Let's hear it first.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the major insights in the Xena poem, if you're going to write an alphabet poem, X is always your hardest letter. So if you, you know, start with Xena, you've got your X line already. So it was a big, you know, kind of, that's a real, like, heads up tip to the, you know, the aspiring alphabet poet writer out there in the audience. The Q is your other, you know, the Q and the X. So this is called Xena Warrior Princess. Absolutely everyone is wild about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and hey, why not? Cute as a little blonde button, no doubt. It's just that I'm more easily excited by chicks in bondage straps and chainmail jerkins. Forgive me, it happens that I dig Xena's thing. I go ballistic when she and Hercules hook up. Oh man, it's incredible what that's like. Pure gravy, 100% natural juice. I'm cranked just thinking about Xena killing all the extras in a flourish after the third commercial. Listen, it's not as totally screwed up as it sounds. My ancient TV gets, like, 60-something channels. No way is that full spectrum. I mean, it's opening another can of nuts altogether, but how can I be positive there's not some even more red-blooded queen of ambidextrous rubber swordplay out there? Some righteous cable access babe in skin-tight skins or tights or Neanderthal whatnot or silver Teflon space bikini or that black elastic rattlesnake suit Uma wore in The Avengers, Uma the Uber Vixen. But what a movie, woof. Some are born to run and some are born to rerun, Xena. So let's ride into that sunset together, babe. You with a posse of buffed-up gal pals. Me at my zenith of carnage and woo.
Campbell McGrath reading Xena Warrior Princess. Each line begins in order with a letter of the alphabet. Absolutely, Buffy, cute, doubt, easily, forgive, go, hook, etc. And I think that one of the functions of a structure like that is to give a poem a direction. On the one hand, it's telling you how long you have and where mm-hmm. you have to get to, but also to stress the fact that it's made of words, that feeling, and this poem has a lot of feeling, is a scrambling of language, emotions that meet the alphabet to form a statement.
Yeah, it's almost a, you know, collage technique in a way. I mean, it's another way of getting at, of reconnecting to words, as you exactly say. I mean, it's a way of forcing yourself back into the dictionary, into the word hoard, to say, well, where am I? Where am I going? What is my U line going to be? And, you know, Obervixen, perfect, you know. So it's a way of, I think, reinstilling a kind of delight and discovery in language, rather than, you know, I mean, I think as a poet, what form does ideally for you is forces you down different paths, you know, neurologically, different, you know, parts of your brain that lie dormant, the sleeping forest there that you don't usually walk through. And suddenly a formal need, whether it's rhyme or an abecedarian, you know, need to come up with the alphabet, forces you to new places. And suddenly you make the discovery of, oh, yeah. Uber Vixen. Why haven't I ever put that in a poem before? It's just been waiting for me here. So that's what that form in general does for me.
Now, I wanted to end with a question about the fate of America, not in the world, but in these poems. We've come through six books to the Pax Atomica, and there's a sense that for all of the impulses toward joy, the ability to sustain a joy about America is fading out. Like the woe poem that comes to an early, a fast end, or the poem about the information age, or the sense, in a way, that the end of the day has come for the traveling poet who went everywhere and wrote prose poem postcards about everywhere he went. There's a sense that America is coming to an end, both as a subject, but also perhaps as a culture, huh?
Oh, you're really a fatalist there, Michael.
I'm afraid of it.
Yeah. I got to say, I remain hugely optimistic, even in, you know, the current very grave kind of cultural moment. And I think, to be honest, being a parent helps you optimistically, because I can't believe, you know, when I go and speak to the classes of the second graders at my kid's school, as I will next week, that, you know, the world that those kids in their kind of, you know, wonderfulness are doomed to perpetuate, you know, our own failings. I still believe that, you know, the renewable resource of humanity still offers endlessly this possibility for change and betterment, which might be naive, but I cling to.
And as a subject for you?
As a subject, I think that it's moving out of center spotlight, merely from both the desire to not repeat myself too endlessly, but also because I'm not sure that I haven't said what I have to say about that complicated subject right now. You know, I'm assuming that I'm going to, as with the capitalist poems that I once thought, you know, had died out and have been reborn, I'm sure I will return endlessly to the culture I know and cherish and want to criticize. But, you know, I feel like American civilization is big enough, but like time and consciousness are now maybe my, you know, more of my kind of issue.
I've been talking with Campbell McGrath, author most recently of Pax Atomica, published by Echo. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael, so much.
You can read a poem from Pax Atomica on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. I'm taping here in the library of the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe. Several members of the foundation are here with us. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Our Santa Fe engineer is Tim Pemberton. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books. Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.